Once or twice I wandered out to the little walled graveyard that stood a mile or so from the village. The dead from the front were normally sent to Sietamo. These were the village dead. It was queerly different from an English graveyard. No reverence for the dead here. Everything overgrown with bushes and coarse grass, human bones littered everywhere. But the really surprising thing was the almost complete lack of religious inscriptions on the gravestones, though they all dated from before the revolution. Only once, I think, I saw the "Pray for the Soul of So-and-so," which is usual on Catholic graves. Most of the inscriptions were purely secular, with ludicrous poems about the virtues of the deceased. On perhaps one grave in four or five, there was a small cross, or a perfunctory reference to heaven. This had usually been chipped off by some industrious atheist with a chisel. It struck me that the people in this part of Spain must be genuinely without religious feeling. Religious feeling, I mean, in the orthodox sense. It's curious that all the time I was in Spain, I never once saw a person cross himself. Yet you would think such a movement would become instinctive, revolution or no revolution. Obviously the Spanish church will come back. As the saying goes, night and the Jesuits always return. But there is no doubt that at the outbreak of the revolution it collapsed and was smashed up to an extent that would be unthinkable even for the moribund C of E in like circumstances. To the Spanish people, at any rate in Catalonia and Aragon, the church was a racket, pure and simple. And possibly Christian belief was replaced to some extent by anarchism, whose influence is widely spread and which undoubtedly has a religious tinge. It was the day I came back from hospital that we advanced the line to what was really its proper position, about 1,000 yards forward along the little stream that lay a couple of 100 yards in front of the fascist lines. This operation ought to have been carried out months earlier. The point of doing it now was that the anarchists were attacking on the Harker Road, and to advance on this side made them divert troops to face us. We were 60 or 70 hours without sleep, and my memories go down into a sort of blur, or rather a series of pictures. Listening duty in no man's land, 100 yards from the Casa Francesa, a fortified farmhouse which was part of the fascist line. 7 hours lying in a horrible marsh in reedy-smelling water into which one's body subsided gradually deeper and deeper. The reedy smell, the numbing cold, the stars immovable in the black sky, the harsh croaking of the frogs. Though this was April, it was the coldest night that I remember in Spain. Only 100 yards behind us, the working parties were hard at it. But there was utter silence except for the chorus of the frogs. Just once during the night I heard a sound, the familiar noise of a sandbag being flattened with a spade. It is queer how, just now and again, Spaniards can carry out a brilliant feat of organisation. The whole move was beautifully planned. In 7 hours, 600 men constructed 1,200 metres of trench and parapet, at distances of from 150 to 300 yards from the fascist line, and all so silently that the fascists heard nothing, and during the night there was only one casualty. There were more next day, of course. Every man had his job assigned to him, even to the cookhouse orderlies, who suddenly arrived when the work was done with buckets of wine laced with brandy. And then the dawn coming up, and the fascists suddenly discovering that we were there. The square white block of the Casa Francesa, though it was 200 yards away, seemed to tower over us, and the machine guns in its sandbagged upper windows seemed to be pointing straight down into the trench. We all stood gaping at it, wondering why the fascists didn't see us. Then a vicious swirl of bullets, and everyone had flung himself on his knees and was frantically digging, deepening the trench, and scooping out small shelters in the side. My arm was still in bandages, I could not dig, and I spent most of that day reading a detective story. The Missing Moneylender, its name was. I don't remember the plot of it, but I remember very clearly the feeling of sitting there reading it, the dampish clay of the trench bottom underneath me, the constant shifting of my legs out of the way as men hurried, stooping down the trench, the crack, crack, crack of bullets a foot or two overhead. Thomas Parker got a bullet through the top of his thigh, which, as he said, was nearer to being a DSO than he cared about. Casualties were happening all along the line. but nothing to what there would have been if they had caught us on the move during the night. A deserter told us afterwards that 5 fascist sentries were shot for negligence. Even now they could have massacred us if they had had the initiative to bring up a few mortars. It was an awkward job getting the wounded down the narrow, crowded trench. I saw one poor devil, his breeches dark with blood, flung out of his stretcher and gasping in agony. One had to carry wounded men a long distance, a mile or more, for even when a road existed, the ambulances never came very near the front line. If they came too near, the fascists had a habit of shelling them. Justifiably, for in modern war no one scruples to use an ambulance for carrying ammunition. And then next night, waiting at Torre Fabian for an attack that was called off at the last moment by wireless. In the barn where we waited, the floor was a thin layer of chaff over deep beds of bones, human bones and cow's bones mixed up, and the place was alive with rats. The filthy brutes came swarming out of the ground on every side. If there is one thing I hate more than another, it is a rat running over me in the darkness. However, I had the satisfaction of catching one of them a good punch that sent him flying, and then waiting 50 or 60 yards from the fascist parapet for the order to attack. A long line of men crouching in an irrigation ditch, with their bayonets peeping over the edge, and the whites of their eyes shining through the darkness. Cop and Benjamin squatting behind us, with a man who had a wireless receiving box strapped to his shoulders. On the western horizon, rosy gun flashes, followed at intervals of several seconds by enormous explosions, and then a pip-pip-pip noise from the wireless, and the whispered order that we were to get out of it while the going was good. We did so, but not quickly enough. 12 wretched children of the JCI, the Youth League of the PUM, corresponding to the JSU of the PSUC, who had been posted only about 40 yards from the fascist parapet, were caught by the dawn and unable to escape. All day they had to lie there with only tufts of grass for cover, the fascists shooting at them every time they moved. By nightfall, 7 were dead. Then the other 5 managed to creep away in the darkness. And then, for many mornings to follow, the sound of the anarchist attacks on the other side of Huesca. Always the same sound. Suddenly, at some time in the small hours, the opening crash of several score bombs bursting simultaneously, even from miles away, a diabolical rending crash. And then the unbroken roar of massed rifles and machine guns, a heavy rolling sound, curiously similar to the roll of drums. By degrees, the firing would spread all round the lines that encircled Huesca, and we would stumble out into the trench to lean sleepily against the parapet while a ragged, meaningless fire swept overhead. In the daytime, the guns thundered fitfully. Torre Fabian, now our cookhouse, was shelled and partially destroyed. It's curious that when you're watching artillery fire from a safe distance, you always want the gunner to hit his mark, even though the mark contains your dinner and some of your comrades. The fascists were shooting well that morning. Perhaps there were German gunners on the job. They bracketed neatly on Torre Fabian. One shell beyond it, one shell short of it, then whizz, boom! Burst rafters leaping upwards, and a sheet of Eurolite skimming down the air like a flicked playing card. The next shell took off the corner of a building as neatly as a giant might do it with a knife. But the cooks produced dinner on time, a memorable feat. As the days went on, the unseen but audible guns began each to assume a distinct personality. There were the 2 batteries of Russian 75mm guns, which fired from close in our rear, and which somehow evoked in my mind the picture of a fat man hitting a golf ball. These were the first Russian guns I had seen, or heard, rather. They had a low trajectory and a very high velocity, so that you heard the cartridge explosion, the whiz, and the shell burst almost simultaneously. Behind Mon Florite were 2 very heavy guns, which fired a few times a day, with a deep, muffled roar that was like the baying of distant, chained-up monsters. Up at Mount Aragon, the medieval fortress which the government troops had stormed last year, the first time in its history, it was said, and which guarded one of the approaches to Huesca, there was a heavy gun which must have dated well back into the 19th century. Its great shells whistled over so slowly that you felt certain you could run beside them and keep up with them. A shell from this gun sounded like nothing so much as a man riding along on a bicycle and whistling. The trench mortars, small though they were, made the most evil sound of all. Their shells are really a kind of winged torpedo, shaped like the darts thrown in public houses, and about the size of a quart bottle. They go off with a devilish metallic crash, as of some monstrous globe of brittle steel being shattered on an anvil. Sometimes our aeroplanes flew over and let loose the aerial torpedoes, whose tremendous echoing roar makes the earth tremble even at 2 miles distance. The shell bursts from the fascist anti-aircraft guns dotted the sky like cloudlets in a bad watercolour, but I never saw them get within 1,000 yards of an aeroplane. When an aeroplane swoops down and uses its machine guns, the sound from below is like the fluttering of wings. On our part of the line, not much was happening. 200 yards to the right of us, where the fascists were on higher ground, their snipers picked off a few of our comrades. 200 yards to the left, at the bridge over the stream, a sort of duel was going on between the fascist mortars and the men who were building a concrete barricade across the bridge. The evil little shells whizzed over, zwing, crash, zwing, crash. 100 yards away, you could stand in perfect safety and watch the columns of earth and black smoke leaping into the air like magic trees. The poor devils round the bridge spent much of the daytime cowering in the little manholes they had scooped in the side of the trench. But there were less casualties than might have been expected, and the barricade rose steadily, a wall of concrete 2 feet thick, with embrasures for 2 machine guns and a small field gun. The concrete was being reinforced with old bedsteads, which apparently was the only iron that could be found for the purpose. Chapter 7. One afternoon, Benjamin told us that he wanted 15 volunteers. The attack on the fascist redoubt, which had been called off on the previous occasion, was to be carried out tonight. I oiled my 10 Mexican cartridges, dirtied my bayonet — the things give your position away if they flash too much — and packed up a hunk of bread, 3 inches of red sausage, and a cigar which my wife had sent from Barcelona and which I had been hoarding for a long time. Bombs were served out, 3 to a man. The Spanish government had at last succeeded in producing a decent bomb. It was on the principle of a Mills bomb, but with 2 pins instead of 1. After you had pulled the pins out, there was an interval of 7 seconds before the bomb exploded. Its chief disadvantage was that 1 pin was very stiff and the other very loose, so that you had the choice of leaving both pins in place and being unable to pull the stiff one out in a moment of emergency, or pulling out the stiff one beforehand and being in a constant stew lest the thing should explode in your pocket. But it was a handy little bomb to throw. A little before midnight, Benjamin led the 15 of us down to Torre Fabian. Ever since evening, the rain had been pelting down. The irrigation ditches were brimming over, and every time you stumbled into one, you were in water up to your waist. In the pitch darkness and sheeting rain in the farmyard, a dim mass of men was waiting. Cop addressed us, first in Spanish, then in English, and explained the plan of attack. The fascist line here made an L bend, and the parapet we were to attack lay on rising ground at the corner of the L. About 30 of us, half English and half Spanish, under the command of Jorge Roca, our battalion commander — a battalion in the militia was about 400 men, and Benjamin — were to creep up and cut the fascist wire. Jorge would fling the first bomb as a signal, then the rest of us were to send in a rain of bombs, drive the fascists out of the parapet, and seize it before they could rally. Simultaneously, 70 shock troopers were to assault the next fascist position, which lay 200 yards to the right of the other, joined to it by a communication trench. To prevent us from shooting each other in the darkness, white armlets would be worn. At this moment, a messenger arrived to say that there were no white armlets. Out of the darkness, a plaintive voice suggested, "Couldn't we arrange for the fascists to wear white armlets instead?" There was an hour or two to put in. The barn over the mule stable was so wrecked by shell fire that you could not move about in it without a light. Half the floor had been torn away by a plunging shell, and there was a 20-foot drop under the stones beneath. Someone found a pick and levered a burst plank out of the floor, and in a few minutes we had got a fire alight and our drenched clothes were steaming. Someone else produced a pack of cards. A rumour, one of those mysterious rumours that are endemic in war, flew round that hot coffee with brandy in it was about to be served. We filed eagerly down the almost collapsing staircase and wandered round the dark yard, inquiring where the coffee was to be found. Alas, there was no coffee. Instead, they called us together, ranged us into single file, and then Jorge and Benjamin set off rapidly into the darkness, the rest of us following. It was still raining and intensely dark, but the wind had dropped. The mud was unspeakable. The paths through the beet fields were simply a succession of lumps, as slippery as a greasy pole, with huge pools everywhere. Long before we got to the place where we were to leave our own parapet, everyone had fallen several times, and our rifles were coated with mud. At the parapet, a small knot of men, our reserves, were waiting, and the doctor and a row of stretchers. We filed through the gap in the parapet and waded through another irrigation ditch. Splash, gurgle. Once again in water up to your waist, with the filthy, slimy mud oozing over your boot tops. On the grass outside, Jorge waited till we were all through. Then, bent almost double, he began creeping slowly forward. The fascist parapet was about 150 yards away. Our one chance of getting there was to move without noise. I was in front with Jorge and Benjamin. Bent double, but with faces raised, we crept into the almost utter darkness at a pace that grew slower at every step. The rain beat lightly in our faces. When I glanced back, I could see the men who were nearest to me, a bunch of humped shapes like huge black mushrooms gliding slowly forward. But every time I raised my head, Benjamin, close beside me, whispered fiercely in my ear, "To keep the head down, to keep the head down." I could have told him that he needn't worry. I knew by experiment that on a dark night you could never see a man at 20 paces. It was far more important to go quietly. If they once heard us, we were done for. They had only to spray the darkness with their machine gun, and there was nothing for it but to run or be massacred. But on the sodden ground it was almost impossible to move quietly. Do what you would, your feet stuck to the mud, and every step you took was slop, 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 slop. And the devil of it was that the wind had dropped, and in spite of the rain it was a very quiet night. Sounds would carry a long way. There was a dreadful moment when I kicked against a tin and thought every fascist within miles must have heard it. But no, not a sound. No answering shot. No movement in the fascist lines. We crept onwards, always more slowly. I cannot convey to you the depth of my desire to get there, just to get within bombing distance before they heard us. At such a time, you have not even any fear, only a tremendous, hopeless longing to get over the intervening ground. I felt exactly the same thing when stalking a wild animal, the same agonized desire to get within range, the same dreamlike certainty that it is impossible. And how the distance stretched out! I knew the ground well, it was barely 150 yards, and yet it seemed more like a mile. When you're creeping at that pace, you are aware as an ant might be of the enormous variations in the ground, the splendid patch of smooth grass here, the evil patch of sticky mud there, the tall, rustling reeds that have got to be avoided, the heap of stones that almost makes you give up hope because it seems impossible to get over it without noise. We had been creeping forward for such an age that I began to think we'd gone the wrong way. Then in the darkness, thin parallel lines of something blacker were faintly visible. It was the outer wire. The fascists had two lines of wire. Jorge knelt down, fumbled in his pocket. He had our only pair of wire cutters. Snip, snip. The trailing stuff was lifted delicately aside. We waited for the men at the back to close up. They seemed to be making a frightful noise. It might be 50 yards to the fascist parapet now. Still onwards, bent double. A stealthy step, lowering your foot as gently as a cat approaching a mouse hole. Then a pause to listen. Then another step. I knew that the inner wire was barely 20 yards from the parapet. It seemed to me inconceivable that 30 men could get there unheard. Our breathing was enough to give us away. Yet somehow we did get there. The fascist parapet was visible now, a dim black mound looming high above us. Once again, Jorge knelt and fumbled. Snip, snip. There was no way of cutting the stuff silently. So that was the inner wire. We crawled through it on all fours, and rather more rapidly. If we had time to deploy now, all was well. Jorge and Benjamin crawled across to the right, but the men behind, who were spread out, had to form into single file to get through the narrow gap in the wire, and just at this moment there was a flash and a bang from the fascist parapet. The sentry had heard us at last. Jorge poised himself on one knee and swung his arm like a bowler. Crash! His bomb burst somewhere over the parapet. At once, far more promptly than one would have thought possible, a roar of fire. 10 or 20 rifles burst out from the fascist parapet. They had been waiting for us, after all. Momentarily, you could see every sandbag in the lurid light. Men too far back were flinging their bombs, and some of them were falling short of the parapet. Every loophole seemed to be spouting jets of flame. It is always hateful to be shot at in the dark. Every rifle flash seems to be pointed straight at you. But it was the bombs that were the worst. You cannot conceive the horror of these things till you have seen one burst close to you and in darkness. In the daytime, there is only the crash of the explosion. In the darkness, there is the blinding red glare as well. I had flung myself down at the first volley. All this while, I was lying on my side in the greasy mud and wrestling savagely with the pin of a bomb. The damn thing would not come out. Finally, I realized that I was twisting it in the wrong direction. I got the pin out, rose to my knees, hurled the bomb, and threw myself down again. The bomb burst over to the right, outside the parapet. Fright had spoiled my aim. Just at this moment, another bomb burst right in front of me, so close that I could feel the heat of the explosion. I flattened myself out and dug my face into the mud so hard that I hurt my neck and thought that I was wounded. Through the din, I heard an English voice behind me say quietly, "I'm hit." The bomb had, in fact, wounded several people round about me without touching myself. I rose to my knees and flung my second bomb. I forget where that one went. The fascists were firing, our people behind were firing, and I was very conscious of being in the middle. I felt the blast of a shot and realized that a man was firing from immediately behind me. I stood up and shouted at him, "Don't shoot at me, you bloody fool!" At this moment I saw that Benjamin, 10 or 15 yards to my right, was motioning to me with his arm. I ran across to him. It meant crossing the line of spouting loopholes, and as I went I clapped my left hand over my cheek. An idiotic gesture, as though one's hand could stop a bullet. But I had a horror of being hit in the face. Benjamin was kneeling on one knee with a pleased, devilish sort of expression on his face, and firing carefully at the rifle flashes with his automatic pistol. Jorge had dropped, wounded, at the first volley and was somewhere out of sight. I knelt beside Benjamin, pulled the pin out of my third bomb and flung it. Ah, no doubt about it that time. The bomb crashed inside the parapet at the corner, just by the machine gun nest. The fascist fire seemed to have slackened very suddenly. Benjamin leapt to his feet and shouted, "Forward! Charge!" We dashed up the short, steep slope on which the parapet stood. I say dashed. Lumbered would be a better word. The fact is that you can't move fast when you're sodden and muddied from head to foot and weighted down with a heavy rifle and bayonet and 150 cartridges. I took it for granted that there would be a fascist waiting for me at the top. If he fired at that range, he couldn't miss me. And yet somehow I never expected him to fire, only to try for me with his bayonet. I seemed to feel in advance the sensation of our bayonets crossing, and I wondered whether his arm would be stronger than mine. However, there was no fascist waiting. With a vague feeling of relief, I found that it was a low parapet, and the sandbags gave a good foothold. As a rule, they're difficult to get over. Everything inside was smashed to pieces, beams flung all over the place, and great shards of uralite littered everywhere. Our bombs had wrecked all the huts and dugouts, and still there was not a soul visible. I thought they would be lurking somewhere underground, and shouted in English, I couldn't think of any Spanish at the moment, "Come on out of it, surrender!" No answer. Then a man, a shadowy figure in the half-light, skipped over the roof of one of the ruined huts and dashed away to the left. I started after him, prodding my bayonet ineffectually into the darkness. As I rounded the corner of the hut, I saw a man, I don't know whether or not it was the same man, as I'd seen before, fleeing up the communication trench that led to the other fascist position. I must have been very close to him, for I could see him clearly. He was bareheaded and seemed to have nothing on except a blanket which he was clutching round his shoulders. If I had fired, I could have blown him to pieces. But for fear of shooting one another, we had been ordered to use only bayonets once we were inside the parapet, and in any case I never even thought of firing. Instead, my mind leapt back 20 years to our boxing instructor at school, showing me in vivid pantomime how he had bayoneted a Turk at the Dardanelles. I gripped my rifle by the small of the butt and lunged at the man's back. He was just out of my reach. Another lunge, still out of reach. And for a little distance we proceeded like this, he rushing up the trench and I after him on the ground above, prodding at his shoulder blades and never quite getting there. A comic memory for me to look back upon, though I suppose it seemed less comic to him. Of course, he knew the ground better than I, and had soon slipped away from me. When I came back, the position was full of shouting men. The noise of firing had lessened somewhat. The fascists were still pouring a heavy fire at us from three sides, but it was coming from a greater distance. We had driven them back for the time being. I remember saying in an oracular manner, "We can hold this place for half an hour, not more." I don't know why I picked on half an hour. Looking over the right-hand parapet, you could see innumerable greenish rifle flashes stabbing the darkness. But they were a long way back, 100 or 200 yards. Our job now was to search the position and loot anything that was worth looting. Benjamin and some others were already scrabbling among the ruins of a big hut or dugout in the middle of the position. Benjamin staggered excitedly through the ruined roof, tugging at the rope handle of an ammunition box. "Comrades! Ammunition! Plenty ammunition here!" "We don't want ammunition," said a voice. "We want rifles." This was true. Half our rifles were jammed with mud and unusable. They could be cleaned, but it's dangerous to take the bolt out of a rifle in the darkness. You put it down somewhere and then you lose it. I had a tiny electric torch which my wife had managed to buy in Barcelona. Otherwise, we had no light of any description among us. A few men with good rifles began a desultory fire at the flashes in the distance. No one dared fire too rapidly. Even the best of the rifles were liable to jam if they got too hot. There were about 16 of us inside the parapet, including one or two who were wounded. A number of wounded, English and Spanish, were lying outside. Patrick O'Hara, a Belfast Irishman who had had some training in first aid, went to and fro with packets of bandages, binding up the wounded men, and of course being shot at every time he returned to the parapet, in spite of his indignant shouts of "Poom!" We began searching the position. There were several dead men lying about, but I did not stop to examine them. The thing I was after was the machine gun. All the while, when we were lying outside, I'd been wondering vaguely why the nest did not fire. I flashed my torch inside the machine gun nest. A bitter disappointment. The gun was not there. Its tripod was there, and various boxes of ammunition and spare parts, but the gun was gone. They must have unscrewed it and carried it off at the first alarm. No doubt they were acting under orders, but it was a stupid and cowardly thing to do, for if they had kept the gun in place, they could have slaughtered the whole lot of us. We were furious. We had set our hearts on capturing a machine gun. We poked here and there, but did not find anything of much value. There were quantities of fascist bombs lying about, a rather inferior type of bomb which you touched off by pulling a string, and I put a couple of them in my pocket as souvenirs. It was impossible not to be struck by the bare misery of the fascist dugouts. The litter of spare clothes, books, food, petty personal belongings that you saw on our own dugouts was completely absent. These poor unpaid conscripts seemed to owe nothing except blankets and a few soggy hunks of bread. Up at the far end there was a small dugout which was partly above ground and had a tiny window. We flashed the torch through the window and instantly raised a cheer. A cylindrical object in a leather case, 4 feet high and 6 inches in diameter, was leaning against the wall, obviously the machine gun barrel. We dashed round and got in at the doorway to find that the thing in the leather case was not a machine gun, but something which in our weapon-starved army was even more precious. It was an enormous telescope, probably of at least 60 or 70 magnifications, with a folding tripod. Such telescopes simply did not exist on our side of the line, and they were desperately needed. We brought it out in triumph and leaned it against the parapet to be carried off later. At this moment, someone shouted that the fascists were closing in. Certainly the din of firing had grown very much louder, but it was obvious that the fascists would not counterattack from the right, which meant crossing no man's land and assaulting their own parapet. If they had any sense at all, they would come at us from inside the line. I went round to the other side of the dugouts. The position was roughly horseshoe-shaped, with the dugouts in the middle, so that we had another parapet covering us on the left. A heavy fire was coming from that direction, but it did not matter greatly. The danger spot was straight in front, where there was no protection at all. A stream of bullets was passing just overhead. They must be coming from the other fascist position farther up the line. Evidently the shock troopers had not captured it after all. But this time the noise was deafening. It was the unbroken, drum-like roar of massed rifles, which I was used to hearing from a little distance. This was the first time I'd been in the middle of it. And by now, of course, the firing had spread along the line for miles around. Douglas Thompson, with a wounded arm dangling useless at his side, was leaning against the parapet and firing one-handed at the flashes. Someone whose rifle had jammed was loading for him. There were four or five of us round this side. It was obvious what we must do. We must drag the sandbags from the front parapet and make a barricade across the unprotected side. And we'd got to be quick. The fire was high at present, but they might lower it at any moment. By the flashes all round, I could see that we had 100 or 200 men against us. We began wrenching the sandbags loose, carrying them 20 yards forward and dumping them into a rough heap. It was a vile job. They were big sandbags, weighing 100 weight each, and it took every ounce of your strength to prise them loose. And then the rotten sacking split and the damp earth cascaded all over you, down your neck and up your sleeves. I remember feeling a deep horror at everything. The chaos, the darkness, the frightful din, the slithering to and fro in the mud, the struggles with the bursting sandbags, all the time encumbered with my rifle, which I dared not put down for fear of losing it. I even shouted to someone as we staggered along with a bag between us, "This is war, isn't it bloody?" Suddenly a succession of tall figures came leaping over the front parapet. As they came nearer, we saw that they wore the uniform of the shock troopers, and we cheered, thinking they were reinforcements. However, there were only four of them, three Germans and a Spaniard. We heard afterwards what had happened to the shock troopers. They did not know the ground, and in the darkness had been led to the wrong place where they were caught on the fascist wire, and numbers of them were shot down. These were four who had got lost, luckily for themselves. The Germans did not speak a word of English, French, or Spanish. With difficulty and much gesticulation, we explained what we were doing and got them to help us in building the barricade. The fascists had brought up a machine gun now. You could see it spitting like a squib over 100 or 200 yards away. The bullets came over us with a steady, frosty crackle. Before long, we had flung enough sandbags into place to make a low breastwork behind which the few men who were on this side of the position could lie down and fire. I was kneeling behind them. A mortar shell whizzed over and crashed somewhere in no man's land. That was another danger, but it would take them some minutes to find our range. Now that we had finished wrestling with those beastly sandbags, it was not bad fun in a way. The noise, the darkness, the flashes approaching, our own men blazing back at the flashes. One even had time to think a little. I remember wondering whether I was frightened, and deciding that I was not. Outside, where I was probably in less danger, I'd been half sick with fright. Suddenly there was another shout that the fascists were closing in. There was no doubt about it this time. The rifle flashes were much nearer. I saw a flash hardly 20 yards away. Obviously they were working their way up the communication trench. At 20 yards, they were within easy bombing range. There were 8 or 9 of us bunched together, and a single well-placed bomb would blow us all to fragments. Bob Smilly, the blood running down his face from a small wound, sprang to his knee and flung a bomb. We cowered, waiting for the crash. The fuse fizzled red as it sailed through the air, but the bomb failed to explode. At least a quarter of these bombs were duds. I had no bombs left except the fascist ones, and I was not certain how these worked. I shouted to the others to know if anyone had a bomb to spare. Douglas Moyle felt in his pocket and passed one across. I flung it and threw myself on my face. By one of those strokes of luck that happen about once in a year, I had managed to drop the bomb almost exactly where the rifle had flashed. There was the roar of the explosion, and then instantly a diabolical outcry of screams and groans. We'd got one of them anyway. I don't know whether he was killed, but certainly he was badly hurt. Poor wretch. Poor wretch. I felt a vague sorrow as I heard him screaming. But at the same instant, in the dim light of the rifle flashes, I saw, or thought I saw, a figure standing near the place where the rifle had flashed. I threw up my rifle and let fly. Another scream. But I think it was still the effect of the bomb. Several more bombs were thrown. The next rifle flashes we saw were a long way off, 100 yards or more. So we had driven them back. Temporarily, at least. Everyone began cursing and saying, why the hell didn't they send us some supports? With a submachine gun or 20 men with clean rifles, we could hold this place against a battalion. At this moment, Paddy Donovan, who was second in command, climbed over the front parapet. Hi! Come on out of it! All men to retire at once! What? Retire! Get out of it! Why? Orders! Back to our own lines, double quick! People were already climbing over the front parapet. Several of them were struggling with a heavy ammunition box. My mind flew to the telescope, which I had left leaning against the parapet on the other side of the position. But at this moment I saw that the 4 shock troopers, acting, I suppose, on some mysterious orders they had received beforehand, had begun running up the communication trench. It led to the other fascist position, and, if they got there, to certain death. They were disappearing into the darkness. I ran after them, trying to think of the Spanish for retire. Finally I shouted, atrás, atrás, which perhaps conveyed the right meaning. The Spaniard understood it and brought the others back. Paddy was waiting at the parapet. Come on, hurry up! Put the telescope, bugger the telescope! Benjamin's waiting outside. We climbed out. Paddy held the wire aside for me. As soon as we got away from the shelter of the fascist parapet, we were under a devilish fire that seemed to be coming at us from every direction. Part of it, I do not doubt, came from our own side, for everyone was firing all along the line. Whichever way we turned, a fresh stream of bullets swept past. We were driven this way and that in the darkness like a flock of sheep. It didn't make it any easier that we were dragging a captured box of ammunition, one of those boxes that hold 1,750 rounds and weigh about 100 weight, besides a box of bombs and several fascist rifles. In a few minutes, although the distance from parapet to parapet was not 200 yards and most of us knew the ground, we were completely lost. We found ourselves slithering about in a muddy field, knowing nothing except that bullets were coming from both sides. There was no moon to go by, but the sky was growing a little lighter. Our lines lay east of Huesca. I wanted to stay where we were till the first crack of dawn showed us which was east and which was west, but the others were against it. We slithered onwards, changing our direction several times and taking it in turns to haul at the ammunition box. At last, we saw the low, flat line of a parapet looming in front of us. It might be ours or it might be the fascists. Nobody had the dimmest idea which way we were going. Benjamin crawled on his belly through some tall, whitish weed till he was about 20 yards from the parapet and tried a challenge. A shout of "Poom!" answered him. We jumped to our feet, found our way along the parapet, slopped once more through the irrigation ditch, splash, gurgle, and were in safety. Cop was waiting inside the parapet with a few Spaniards. The doctor and the stretchers were gone. It appeared that all the wounded had been got in except Jorge and one of our own men, Hiddleston by name, who were missing. Cop was pacing up and down, very pale. Even the fat folds at the back of his neck were pale. He was paying no attention to the bullets that streamed over the low parapet and cracked close to his head. Most of us were squatting behind the parapet for cover. Cop was muttering, Jorge. Cogno. Jorge. And then in English, if Jorge is gone, it is terrible, terrible. Jorge was his personal friend and one of his best officers. Suddenly he turned to us and asked for 5 volunteers, 2 English and 3 Spanish, to go and look for the missing men. Moyle and I volunteered with 3 Spaniards. As we got outside, the Spaniards murmured that it was getting dangerously light. This was true enough. The sky was dimly blue. There was a tremendous noise of excited voices coming from the fascist redoubt. Evidently, they had reoccupied the place in much greater force than before. We were 60 or 70 yards from the parapet when they must have seen or heard us, for they sent over a heavy burst of fire which made us drop on our faces. One of them flung a bomb over the parapet, a sure sign of panic. We were lying in the grass, waiting for an opportunity to move on, when we either heard, or thought we heard, I've no doubt it was pure imagination, but it seemed real enough at the time, that the fascist voices were much closer. They had left the parapet and were coming after us. Run! I yelled to Moyle and jumped to my feet, and heavens how I ran. I had thought earlier in the night that you can't run when you're sodden from head to foot and weighted down with a rifle and cartridges. I learn now that you can always run when you think you have 50 or 100 armed men after you. But if I could run fast, others could run faster. In my flight, something that might have been a shower of meteors sped past me. It was the 3 Spaniards, who had been in front. They were back to our own parapet before they stopped and I could catch up with them. The truth was that our nerves were all to pieces. I knew, however, that in a half-light one man is invisible where 5 are clearly visible. So I went back alone. I managed to get to the outer wire and search the ground as well as I could, which was not very well, for I had to lie on my belly. There was no sign of Jorge or Hiddleston, so I crept back.